Welcome back. This is the 20-Minute VC with me, Harry Stebbings, and I'm so excited for the episode today. I think it's one of the greatest branding tactics when it comes to the naming of this company, and I'm definitely going to butcher it, so I want a warning ahead of time. But here goes, and I'm so thrilled to welcome Phil Libin back to the hot seat today. Now, Phil is the founder and CEO at the app that allows you to level up your remote presentations, making high-quality video content in minutes. Phil has raised over $30 million for the company from an incredible array of investors, including Sequoia, Kevin and Julia Hartz, Tony Fadell, Instagram's Kevin Systrom and Mike Krieger, and Brianne Kimmel, to name a few. Prior to Phil was a managing director at General Catalyst, and prior to his time in venture, Phil most famously founded Evernote, where he led the business with phenomenal success as CEO for over 8 years. I'd also want to say a huge thank you to Biz Stone and Julia Hartz, two prior guests on the show, for some fantastic question suggestions today. They really did so help me in preparing this schedule. But before we dive into the show today, I have to say, I just love using AngelList fund admin platform to manage my investments with 20VC. The team and the platform at AngelList takes care of all my back office needs so that I can focus on working with great founders. Leading fund managers have made over 10,000 investments into 6,000 startups via AngelList, all online and all in one place. And with the recently announced rolling funds, you can easily find and invest in these top fund managers on angellist.com/rolling. And speaking of incredible products that allow you to do things that you simply didn't think were possible before, in 2021, every business is a global business, but how do you pay your global team and comply with international labor laws? Well, Remote handles payroll, benefits, taxes, and compliance to help companies of all sizes to pay and manage full-time and contract workers all over the world, no matter where your team lives and works. Remote's global employment solutions keep your team, your finances, and your IP secure. Remote never charges percentages or fees, just best-in-class global employment solutions for a low flat rate. The world's top companies love Remote. GitLab, the world's largest all-remote organization, trusts Remote to manage their global team, and Remote is funded by Index Ventures, Sequoia, and a host of other top-tier investors. I'm very proud to call myself a Remote investor. I'm ready to learn more? Well, visit remote.com/20VC today to download Remote's latest research report and start employing in minutes. And as I said, speaking of game-changing products with Remote to use at your company, we've all heard that time is money, and so Ramp says, why don't you save both? Ramp is the only spend management platform and corporate card that can really automate your accounting and lower your bills in under 15 minutes. That's even less than the 20VC podcast, my word. And Ramp allows you to streamline approvals, controlling spend before it happens. Ramp also has this awesome feature where it automatically identifies all active subscriptions and upcoming payments, allowing you to forecast in real time. For these and many more reasons, some of the best use Ramp, including 8 Sleep, Row, Founders Fund, and more. To join the revolution of saving both time and money with Ramp, head over to ramp.com. But that is quite enough of these dulcet British tones, so now I'm thrilled to hand over to Phil Libin, founder and CEO at
3, 2, 1, 0. You have now arrived at your destination.
Phil, it is great to have you on the show today. Thank you so much for joining my dulcet British tones once again.
Thank you, Harry. Great to be back on.
I do want to kick off there, and for those that maybe missed our first episode, tell me, how did you make your way into the world of startups, and how did you come to found
Well, this is my fifth startup, and yeah, I guess I started my first company back in 1997, one of the first dot-com companies. We built stuff for the internet. I'm kind of doing it ever since, but I never really intended to do any of these things. I don't like self-identify as an entrepreneur. It just kind of keeps happening for some reason.
What was the founding moment for you with
Well, it was basically, I think we started in this May, and so it was already a few months into the lockdown, into the pandemic, and we were all just, you know, sitting around living on video and finding that to be pretty dreary. And I was just goofing around. I mean, started as a joke, just as a way to make our life on video a little bit less boring. So we just started goofing around with backgrounds and pictures and things you can do in Zoom, and pretty soon it became a product.
Yeah, no, totally. And I remember those first few months were pretty terrible. Tell me, I want to start with 2 points, really. And it's like, as you mentioned, you know, the fifth company with now. And so it's like, what fundamentally worked at Evernote, obviously, which is kind of the most famous, but also what worked with the prior companies that you've taken with you to and you've really run with today?
A lot of what worked really well at Evernote was a lot of the people. A lot of the early Evernote crew is you know, we're still together for and for All Turtles. And that's the main thing, right? It comes down to the team and the people, and I'm just super lucky to still be in the same orbit as a bunch of these folks. And then there's the thing that we did at Evernote that...
What do you think is the secret to such high retention? As you said there, you know, people move around so fluidly today. What do you think is the secret to retaining and
kind of maintaining that incredible team for so long?
Well, I mean, I've just tried really hard to like stick around with all these people, right? I don't really see myself as like the central convener of it. It's kind of the opposite. Like, I'm just trying to like make sure I still get to work with as many really talented people as possible. And, you know, and then we wind up together. It isn't so much about like actively thinking about assembling a team, at least in the beginning. It's really just about, you know, who are the best people that I know and what can we do together? And, you know, will they let me work with them again?
So I love that in terms of kind of almost kind of the informal gathering. When does one have to start placing structure around it? Because, you know, you've raised the I think, $31 million round recently. Like, and with the scaling of funds and scaling of org, when does one have to go from, you know, social gathering, informal, incredibly talented people to a much more kind of hierarchical organization or a much more structured organization?
Yeah, structured, not necessarily hierarchical, but structured, I think really fast, especially around, you know, hiring. One of the many things that are wrong with startups is startups are all about shortcuts. All of the incentives are to take as many shortcuts as you can. The biggest shortcut that you can take is just hiring your friends. And this is a really fast way to get started, but it's ultimately, I think, pretty damaging to the company and to society in general. And figuring out how to be more disciplined around hiring, around retention is really a day one thing. So we've tried to be, this is one of the founding principles of Behind All Turtles, behind the product studio that came out of, is that we take the team building very seriously. So yeah, we have all sorts of processes in place to try to get good outcomes, try to make sure that we can keep working with people that we know are really fantastic, but we're always looking for new people who are outside of our core social networks, outside of our connections, and we have to make sure that we are working with people who aren't just our friends and people we went to college with.
Can I ask, what's been the most effective there? You know, I speak to a lot of founders and they're like, should we do hackathons? Should we go into colleges and do sponsored events? How should we really expand our network and get the most talented people in? In terms of like effective processes, insights that you have from expanding that network, what's worked?
You spend money on it. I mean, for businesses, you pretty much, it all comes down to the same tool, which is money. So if you're not spending money on it, you're not serious about it. So we spend money on recruiters, and we specifically tell recruiters that we are paying you money to send us people that are outside of our comfort zones and outside of our networks, because we know plenty of, you know, middle-aged white dudes. And so there's going to be no shortage of, you know, just people that I went to college with, people that I'm friends with, like they're all going to be in the network anyway. We're talking to all these people. So if we're going to pay recruiters above and beyond that, we specifically want to pay recruiters to send us candidates that we wouldn't otherwise be seeing. It works. You know, it's a business. You pay money, you get good service.
Carlos, in terms of, you mentioned shortcuts there being so paramount and a big mistake that a lot of startups make. Why do you think startups make shortcuts so often? Like, you've been on both the VC side and the founder side now, obviously multiple times on the founder side. I kind of blame the VC model maybe, but like, how do you think about the reasoning behind the shortcuts?
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely your fault. It's definitely the VCs.
I mean, you were a VC, Phil.
Yeah, and I still do some investing. Yeah, no, we made this industry. Yeah, I think the incentives, look, think about the startup incentive, right? It's the incentives are, when you're investing, especially if you're doing early stage investing, just like me, you're not looking for things that are likely to succeed, right? You're looking for things that have a plausible chance of succeeding, even if it's not a huge chance, but that if it does succeed, it's going to be massive, right? And so all of the incentives are lined up for deploy money as much as you can sometimes once your funds get bigger and bigger, and deploy them into things that are either going to fail quickly, because the last thing a VC wants is to like hang around a perpetually stalled startup, or succeed massively quickly. And even if the chance of success, like you don't have to believe, when you make an investment, you don't have to believe that it's a 90% likely chance of success. You know, depending on the stage, maybe you think it's only a 2% likely, or 10% or 30% or whatever. And so all of those incentives are go fast, break things, take shortcuts. I mean, that's just the game. It has some interesting effects, and many of those effects I think are negative. And so we've been trying to do things a little bit differently, just because, again, this is my fifth one. So at some point, I'm bound to demonstrate learning behavior.
Can I ask, were you tempted to keep in All Turtles? Like, what was the thinking behind spinning it out as a separate company?
Well, that's kind of the model, right? We want to, of All Turtles, the idea is we want to make products that are worthwhile, that are kind of good for the world, that if they succeed, people are happier and healthier. And we want to do it with as little nonsense as possible. And we don't fetishize the form of ownership of that product. So we're not trying to make startups, we're trying to make successful products. And some of these products would be better off, you know, they fulfill their potential better if they are in standalone companies, like startups, and so we would spin those out. And others might be better off if they're just a product as part of, you know, as part of All Turtles, or as part of one of our, you know, large corporate partners. We don't have a particular startup fetish. We just say, like, what's best for each product to reach its full potential. And for, since I think this this is a multi-trillion dollar thing that's happening right now, I think needed to get pretty big, pretty quickly, raise external capital. And so it was a perfect thing to say, okay, yeah, embodying this in a spin-out startup is the right approach. Whereas for some other things we work on, that's not necessarily the right approach.
You know, you speak with such clarity and directness when you talk about kind of recruitment, when you talk about fundraising, and bluntly, management and leadership is something that is sometimes innate and sometimes it comes over time. How would you describe your management style and leadership style today?
Well, look, my favorite thing in the world about being a manager, the best thing ever, the thing that makes me the happiest as a manager is when I see something that the team has done and it's amazingly good and I didn't know anything about it or have anything to do with it. Like, those are the moments that like you live for as a CEO, as a manager. The team does something that is amazingly great and you had nothing to do with it. You barely even knew that anyone was working on it. Like, all I try to do is just to increase the number of times that happens. You know, it's a balance, right? You can't, obviously, if I'm like micromanaging everything, that'll never happen because I'll always know about everything. So like I ruined the, oh my God, you guys did this and it's amazing and I didn't even know, I'm so happy. On the flip side, if everything is just a bit like too lax, it's hard to actually build a team with people that are capable of doing that. So I just try to, I think my manager style tries to maximize for how often can the team just do something completely without me that is far better than had I been involved in it.
Do you find it difficult to delegate? So like, it sounds awful, but like, I find it difficult to delegate, say, with the media company, because bluntly, it sounds terribly arrogant, but just, I know my own company well, obviously. Like, I don't feel other people can do things as well as I can, so I just struggle so much. How do you get over that?
I mean, there's your problem, Harry. That's it. You just said it. I can help you with this. This is founder therapy, man. You just gave away the answer, right? The answer is you know that you can do things better than the other people on your team. So never hire someone whose job you can do better than them. Only hire people, only surround yourself with people that are ridiculously better than you or that are superior to you in their job or in other things as much as possible. Like, always be the worst person at any given job in your company. And if you do that, then you have no problem delegating. Like, I have no problem delegating because I know that everyone who's doing their job, if they got to be in our company, it's because they are ridiculously better at their job than I am. And I'm decent at a bunch of jobs, but obviously everyone that actually works with me is a professional is much better than I am. So if I delegate, if I micromanage, the outcome is just going to be worse because not the best person did it. So yeah, it all just comes down to like knowing that the job of the CEO is to kind of be the worst person in the company at any given function, or else you're doing it wrong.
Yeah, no, I get you. It's a tricky one. It's a tricky one.
It's not tricky, man. It's like all you got to do is change the focus from you think you have to micromanage, but really you change the focus to what you're after are the results. So what you want is excellent results, and you can be a good judge of what's excellent, but you just want excellent results. And if you think you have to do the steps yourself in order to achieve excellent results, that means you haven't hired people that are better than you at their job. It's actually really straightforward. Like, it is your failure if you have not hired people that you think are better than you at their job. Then you just have to, you know, hire different people.
Okay, I'm enjoying this. Let me push back on you and say, what if it's incredibly network oriented, where it's personal relationships govern just 99% of what I do, and you can't really delegate? I mean, it's the fact, do you know what I mean? It's the relationship that drives the business in a lot of respects, and that doesn't delegate well. How do you evolve around that?
You know, a sign of like a non-serious business is when people in it say this is a relationship business. This is a sign of like it's immature and it's not professionalized yet. No, like you used to hear this a lot in Hollywood, right? It'd be like, oh, like movie making. No, it's all a relationship business. And then Netflix came along and they're like, okay, yeah, that's nice. We're just going to be professionals about it. So we're just going to do every part and we're going to spend money on it and we're going to do it correctly. And it turns out, yeah, it's a relationship business, but really, you know, you can just hire and attract amazing people. So like, that's a crutch. Like, whenever I find myself thinking, oh, it's a relationship business, and I find myself thinking that a lot, but whenever I find myself thinking that, it's like I have these like red flags that have like programmed my brain. And whenever I have that thought, I'm like, ding, I'm being an amateur about something. Okay, well, how do I solve this with the tools at my disposal? So yeah, I mean, if you're hiring people or if you're working with people based primarily on your relationships with them, then yeah, it's difficult. But what would Netflix do? What would a hyper-professionalized and industrialized version of your company look like? That's kind of the exercise that I go through. And very often it just comes down to, you know, make sure you just hire really good people and then you get out of their way.
This is really interesting. Sorry, it's totally off schedule, but it's like everyone also says on the show, you know, for VCs always say on the show, you know, Harry, venture, it's all about people. It's just such a relationships game. That's venture. Like, when you look back at that now and given what you just said, do you think like actually that's complete crap? Or do you actually think, no, venture's a model that doesn't scale? They are right. It's this cottage industry.
I've got this model, this mental model that served me pretty well, which is, I call it, my brain is not my friend. I realize that my brain, like I think of my brain as like not really my friend. He's kind of a doofusy roommate. Like, I've got this this doofusy roommate that lives in my head. And you know, he's my roommate, so I kind of got to make sure he's not, like, kind of happy. But he's kind of a dope. Kind of, like, randomly, like, gets obsessed about things and, like, thinks about stuff and says random things about what he saw on the internet. And, you know, I kind of like him. He's my roommate. But, like, just because, like, my doofusy brain roommate happened to, like, think something doesn't make it true. Doesn't make it, like, more likely to be correct than if I heard it, you know, from somebody on the street. And so I try to, like, not prioritize my own thoughts and biases in this model. And whenever I catch my doofusy roommate making an obvious excuse, I'm like, oh, okay, that's an obvious excuse. Oh, sure, it's a relationship business. Obvious excuse, doofusy roommate. Now, I don't have to correct it all the time because sometimes you're like, eh, you know, that's just the way it's going to be and it's fine, it's fine. But just, like, acknowledge that, like, this is an imperfect being, you know, your brain, easily fooled, easily deluded, prone to making excuses, you know, kind of lovable, but whatever. And just go from that perspective. And if your job is to professionalize, then you act in one way without realization. But sometimes also understand that that's not your job. Maybe you don't want to change it, and that's fine. Maybe you kind of want to be, you know, in a cottage industry because that's what you like about it. Cottages are nice. They're cozy. That's fine, too. That's kind of my approach to all of this stuff.
I like it. Can I ask, have you always had this self-awareness, or is it... I'm sorry, I'm not meaning to kind of over-flattering of you, but have you always had that? Because it is very self-aware, and it's very thoughtful and wise. Like, have you always had that, or does it come with age and wisdom, Phil?
I mean, I probably still don't really have it. I think maybe I'm just going through a phase where I'm good at faking it, and then, you know, the real awareness will come later. I just have to talk as if I'm self-aware. Yeah, it's... I feel like I've absorbed a lot as I've gotten older, but I also feel like I've dumber now than I've ever been before.
Did being on the investor side of the table change how you think about operating successfully?
Yeah. I think being a VC was a really great experience. So I was a general catalyst, and it's a really amazing team. I learned a ton from lots of people there. Hemant in particular is just a really brilliant person. He's one of the best, like, first principles thinkers, you know, that I've worked with. And it was a painful and fascinating process of sitting with founders, like, in board meetings and in pitches, and, like, and being like, oh my God, that's me. Like, those are all of the mistakes that I make all the time. And yeah, seeing it from the other side was huge. I don't think it was a very good VC. I think one of the reasons that I wasn't very good at it is, and this is Hemant diagnosed this on, like, day three. He's like, when you hear a pitch, you get excited about what you would do with this idea. And that's a really shitty way to make investments, because you're not going to do anything with this idea. You got to try to figure out what they're going to do with this idea. And, like, that's true, right? That was it. Like, I was processing everything as a CEO would. It was like, oh, cool. Yeah, this is a good idea. Like, let's do it. What are we going to do with it? And of course, as an investor, that's irrelevant because you're not going to do anything. And one of the things that made me realize really quickly is like, oh, but I don't want to just, like, pick winners. I want to make things. It was like 2 years of self-reflection that was, I think, very important. And it feels like I'm a better founder and CEO because of my kind of 2 year stint on the other side of the table. But we'll see. It hasn't been long enough to know yet.
Well, I'm sure it was a pretty amazing experience with Hemant. He's awesome. Speaking of kind of how you think, I spoke to Chris O'Neill, who obviously was at Evernote also. And he said, Phil sees the world differently 99% of us. Talk to me, what do you think he meant by that? And how do you think about the ideation process, the creation process, and really kind of seeing the world differently, as he mentioned?
That's a good question. I think part of probably one of the things that I do that a lot of people don't is, again, I try not to be infatuated with my own thoughts. I think that's actually a very common thing in other cultures, but in Western cultures, particularly in the US, we are so indoctrinated from an early age about how, like, our opinions and our thoughts are magical and privileged and, like, amazing, and everyone has an opinion, and everyone is like, your thoughts and preferences are important. You know, modern sort of ad-based micro-targeted businesses have just made that infinitely worse. And so we are all told every day about how our opinions matter. Actually, they don't that much. And, like, the people they should matter the least to is ourselves. So I think, like, maybe the thing that I just kind of woke up to one day is this idea that, yeah, just because I believe something strongly doesn't actually make it any more or less likely to be accurate or true than if some random person in the street believed in it strongly. I should question it the same way and just, you know, not be infatuated with myself. At least I try.
Can I ask, I think often a hard thing in leadership is, like, the weight of one's words. You say something in a meeting and suddenly 3 weeks later it's done and, you know, it's been executed on, and it's easy to forget the weight of one's words with team members, especially as kind of an experienced leader. How do you think about that, given what you just said?
I try to tell people that work with me that it's not your job to do what I say. It's your job to do the right thing. And sometimes, hopefully, you know, more frequently than not, if I say something, maybe I'm pointing things to the right direction, but sometimes I'm not. Sometimes I'm just wrong. Often I'm just wrong. You don't get credit for like doing what I've said to do if the outcome isn't great. And the flip side of that is you get massive credit for like not doing what I've asked for if it turns out to be the right thing. In fact, much more credit than, you know, that like I said before, like my favorite thing in the world is when the team does something that I was not involved with that comes out, you know, amazingly good. So, you know, like there are no points for following instructions. There's only points for succeeding, for doing the right stuff. And we try to just have a culture that like that is what's expected. And some of that is having a little bit of humility about saying like, look, just because I'm like speaking confidently about something doesn't mean I'm right. That's just like an old vaudeville move. Like I speak confidently about things and wave my hands around. It doesn't mean I'm actually correct about it at all. What's important is what's going to be the end result, not what our intentions are. And I love being proven wrong about something. Kind of cultivated a taste for that. Prove that I'm wrong in a way that actually makes the outcome like really good. You just made me really happy.
Can I ask, is there anything that you do or one can do or lessons that you've learned in terms of like encouraging debate, encouraging live conversation and really thoughtful discussion within companies without kind of functional leaders or leaders not dictating, but having much more of a firm stance and people following? How do you encourage that debate and dissent internally?
It's tough. And I think actually one of the things that I've realized is better in the current world where we're mostly working remote, which I kind of had a glimpse of before, but I don't think I fully appreciate it to the extent of which it was easy for me to be a bully in meetings and to really kind of dominate a lot of the discussion in in-person meetings, which a bunch of people who did well and who've been like hanging around me for a while are fine with. They're kind of fine with that style. But there's a lot of people who don't want to tell the CEO to shut up, even though they should, and even though their ideas are right and correct. There's a lot of really brilliant, creative people who are maybe a little bit shy, maybe a little bit introverted, maybe a little bit younger, and like just don't have the self-confidence yet. I think all of us do this to some extent, but I think I was pretty bad at like shutting those people out just because I was so, you know, I could like dominate, you know, a meeting, a discussion. When we went from being in person to doing all of these things, you know, we no longer do brainstorming in a big conference room with, you know, stickies, post-it notes, you know, now we do it all on Figma. And actually I started noticing, man, I'm just getting a lot more productivity out of the quiet people. Like it turns out there's a lot of these people that like, I just don't think would have been as effective back in person, but it actually turns out they're brilliant. They just need, you know, they don't jump to conclusions as quickly as I do. They need a little bit more time to say something. They're a little bit quieter. And that is a cognitive style that I think I was suppressing. That just became clear once we weren't in person that I was suppressing it. And all of a sudden, hey, great news. Like now we're like far more creative than ever before. So again, some of it is just being aware of like, what am I screwing up? And how do I screw it up less? Not being like angry at myself for it. Just kind of actually being delighted when I discover something like, oh, man, there's this thing. I've been making this mistake for the past 40 years. Let's stop making it. All right, things are incrementally better now. It's kind of a beautiful thing.
Do you structure your reviews of yourself or do postmortems in any way? How do you think about just being disciplined around that? Because otherwise it's kind of easy just to drift through as one is.
Yeah, I mean, we don't have a formalized review process yet. We should. That's actually been a thing that I have not succeeded at a company is figuring out how to do like reviews that are like meaningful. Like we always try different things and, you know, sometimes they work, but honestly, like I just haven't had good success with like reviews that felt more useful than harmful, which doesn't mean to like stop trying. It actually means you have to like try harder because it's clearly a really important thing. I think, you know, for my own self, I think I take plenty of time, you know, in reading and reflection and just kind of, you know, collecting my thoughts and, you know, and realizing that again, my thoughts aren't not any more special than anyone else's thoughts.
I do want to move a little bit more though to and to the market around And so I want to specifically ask around like, and I spoke to Naomi, I spoke to Chris, I spoke to Roloff, and they all said about this, which is I ask about consumer application usage versus business application usage. How do you see the two differing usage patterns and where fits in?
I kind of love that question because I think it highlights a method of inquiry, a way that we think we gain knowledge, which is on the one hand, like very well developed and very useful. And on the other hand, like completely inadequate to most things, which is the differences, like analyzing the differences. How is B2B different from B2C? You know, how are product managers different from project managers? How are, you know, dogs different from cats? And you definitely learn a lot by looking at the differences. But I actually think very often, like you learn more by looking at the similarities and understanding why are they the same. So like if you reframe that question as like, well, how is consumer business the same as an enterprise business? Like that's kind of interesting. And why is it the same? What are the things that like make it go the same way? Like why have we arbitrarily drawn these dividing lines between things? This is like a very Western way of understanding. This is like the, you know, you can learn a little bit about a frog by dissecting it, but you can learn a lot more about frogs by not dissecting them. You can like learn a lot more about frogs by like going and hanging out with some frogs. And we just don't do that a lot. Like so much of our analytics, stats, metrics, you know, what people teach in business school and science is really about like the taxonomy of, you know, how do you carve things out and you say this thing goes over here and this thing goes over there. And it's all useful. There's obviously tons of stuff you can read about that. But I actually find that the complement of that also super useful, which is just like force myself to think about, well, what are the things that are, that unify this? So I think that businesses are made of people and people choose to make, you know, purchases and decisions. And in some ways they do it the same way that individuals do. And in some ways it's different. And the differences are obvious, but the similarities are subtle and I think more important. And so I like focus on those.
I do want to ask that in terms of like the market itself, obviously Zoom hangs above the market as kind of the dominant market leader, both for kind of consumer and business. Mm-hmm. Can I ask, I think quite strongly that, you know, there's so many different specific feature requests and verticals that need to be built out. We're going to see this kind of generation of unbundling Zoom for musical instrument instructors to fitness teachers to meditation guides, you name it. Like, how do you think about the unbundling of Zoom? And do you think that will happen or do you think it won't happen?
So I don't think we know, because I think we are right now in the beginning of a multi-trillion dollar restructuring of the world that to me feels bigger than, you know, when I started my first company, it was 1987, a company called Engine 5. You're one of the first dot-com companies. It was like right at the beginning of like the commercial internet being everywhere. And I remember getting into these debates with people in 97 where people would say, well, what percentage of companies do you think are going to be on the internet? And some people were like, we think 25% of companies are going to be on the internet. And other people were like, that's crazy. It won't be more than 2%. And we were like, we think it's going to be 100%. And, you know, it was 100%. It took like a decade, but 100% of, close to 100% of all organizations like wound up getting on the internet. And that wound up transforming absolutely everything about everything. And now the same thing is happening with video, where 9 months ago in the before times, like what percentage of every school, hospital, church, restaurant, big enterprise, small company, store, what percentage of all of them had to conduct important parts of their business over video? Like 1% 9 months ago? Now and in the future, it's going to be close to 100%. So like integrating video into everything in this hybrid model is going to literally affect almost 100% of all things in life. It's going to be a bigger transformation as the dot-com transformation was, except it's not going to take 10 years. It's going to take like 2 years and we're probably 6 months into it. So this is a massive like reordering of the world. And whenever something like this happens, the first thing is no one knows what are the platforms and what are the applications? What are the horizontal things and what are the vertical things? Like we just don't know yet. It's a giant furball of all of us trying to figure it out. So is Zoom a platform or an application? Well, it's a little bit of both, but how is it going to diverge? Is platform or an application? Are we going to write for dentists and for stockbrokers and for dogs? Or are other people going to do that and we're the platform? I don't know yet. I don't think we know yet. It's one of the reasons why we wanted to raise, you know, a decent amount of money. We took $36 million is because we want to be at the table figuring these things out alongside of the rest of the industry. And it's all going to get shaken out in the next like 12 months. So it'll be kind of a fascinating time.
Now, do you think like the 100% transition to video is purely predicated on the kind of complete transition to work from home and remote work?
No, and I don't think it's going to be, I should be clear about that. I don't think that it's going to be 100% transition to video, meaning that 100% of the things we'll do over video. I think that 100% of the things we'll do will be impacted by video. Just like with the internet. It's not like 100% of everything we do over the internet. It's just that the internet has integrated itself into close to 100% of like everything. It's like it underlies everything. I think it's going to be the same thing with video. It's going to be this hybrid world where even when we're traveling and going to restaurants, we're going to be interacting with important parts of the world on an almost daily basis over video. And not video the way it is now, not meetings. You know, currently, so this always happens. Again, whenever there's a major transformation, like imagine the very first movies, like the first films, like in the 19-teens and 1920s, you know, they invented the film cameras, but they hadn't yet invented cinema. And so like the old reality that they knew was theater, was actors on a stage. And so the first movies were just like, you know, they put a camera and they record some actors on a stage. And because they hadn't invented like close-ups and cutaways and video editing and two camera shots. And so like the first movies were just like a poor replacement for theater, but that was more scalable. It wasn't until decades later that people figured out actually movies aren't about a replacement for the theater. They're an entirely new thing. Same thing happened with television. Same thing happened, you know, when we were starting at Evernote, 2007, 2008, it was was smartphones were like the giant transformation. So everyone had smartphones, but companies knew the old reality, which was, you know, Microsoft like knew how to make Microsoft Word. And so people were like, oh, well, maybe smartphone software is just like a shrunken down version of Microsoft Word. And it wasn't. Like, that's the first generation thinking, right? That's like trying to recreate the old reality in the new technology. And it wasn't until the native to smartphone applications like Evernote and Uber and Airbnb, right, came around that we like invented what the new thing was. And that's happening now with video. So the first generation players, the players who are dominating it, are sitting around saying, okay, right, meetings. What were meetings? Meetings were a bunch of boring people sitting in a boring room. Now they can't be in the same room anymore because of COVID. So how do we get as close as possible to a bunch of boring people in a boring room, but with computers? That's the first gen thinking around like video conferencing. And obviously within a year, like this isn't what video is going to be like. Obviously it's going to be the next generation of like native to video companies that comes along and says, well, no, we're not trying to recreate the old reality. We're not trying to recreate meetings. We're trying to like rebuild the world in a way that could never be done before we had this capability. And a bunch of startups like us are going to be doing that, but also like all of the big companies. Of course, Zoom knows this, and of course they're working on it. And Zoom is brilliant people, and it's a brilliant company, as does Microsoft, as does Google, as does Apple. So like over the next, you know, year to 2 years, every single incumbent player and, you know, a few thousand startups are like figuring out this entire new world. And I think anyone who says that, anyone who's like confidently projects how it's going to go is like, you know what they're talking about. I just want to be in the Zoom where it happened.
I'm going to be honest, Phil. I can see why you moved on from venture, because you say things like that and then you say, I wave my hands and I say things. It doesn't mean I'm right. And I'm like, yep, that's not a VC. Now, I'm going to ask, man, you said about like obviously raising the decent chunk of money that you did from, you know, Sequoia and the incredible investors you did. Like, was there a concern for you? Because Bunny, with the track that you have and the experience that you have, you could raise pretty much whatever you want. Was there a concern for you about raising too much too soon and being one of these overfunded, too fast companies that don't have maybe the discipline?
I mean, look, I think it's discipline, right? It's just having discipline. And I trust my team enough to know that we have discipline at this point. So, you know, I'm not going to, like, we're not going to fail. I think as Roloff puts it, right, of indigestion, he says, you know, a lot of startups like fail from indigestion more than starvation. In Silicon Valley, I think, you know, the world over, that's probably pretty reversed. And, you know, not getting indigestion really is about discipline, and discipline is hard. But at this point, I trust the team enough that we are not going to fail because we raised too much money.
Sorry, this is really personal. Why would you fail, do you think? I don't think you will. Obviously, and there's a downside thinking, but like, what does worry?
I mean, the biggest mistakes are always, you know, are usually people mistakes. And, you know, there's sort of like two classes of errors, right? There's like two classes of mistakes. There's like things that were actually like that are only mistakes in hindsight, that like knowing what you know now, you would do things differently because you know how the world turned out. But those aren't really mistakes, right? Those are just like odds. And so the most likely reason that I think we would fail is because we play some wrong bets, not because we make like fatal errors, but just because like we bet on ways that the world is going to go, that the world doesn't go in that way. Those aren't like, without the benefit of, you know, time travel, there's no way to really correct for that. And that's why it's venture, right? It's not meant to be a high probability of success. It's just meant to be a, you know, a plausible probability of big success.
Well, how do you think about that, like protecting the downside? And what I mean by that is you have a view for the future. You can absolutely invest in and go hard for it. And if you're right, fuck yeah. But then also, like, does one need to just set the foundational layer of risk and be like, oh, but if that doesn't work, we're fine and we've got this, this, and this?
Not at an early stage. I think at an early stage, you know, this is not a business that needs to survive at a small level. We haven't built anything yet that's like that needs to be protected. You know, everyone actually, you know, who's involved with the company is super employable. Like, people's lives and livelihoods aren't really on the line yet. It's, you know, it's a few dozen people who can get jobs anywhere, who, you know, we'd help get jobs anywhere. So I think at this point, it's more about how do we have impact? Like, what is the shortest way to get to impact? It's not about going big. I actually don't care about the scale. I don't care about the size. I care about the impact. I care about, we want to become the default answer to some important question for some people. Like, we want for somebody, hopefully a large number eventually, but initially for somebody to be like, oh, for this important area of my life, is my default answer. Is my go-to. We want to have that impact. We want people to say, my life and my livelihood is fundamentally better than it was before because this product is in my life. So how do we get to that? And then once we've gotten to that, how do we know that we're there? And then once we've gotten to that, how do we grow the number of people that we keep having this, that we can have this impact to? And then our ultimate scale, our ultimate size is going to be dependent on what is the natural scale of that. And if it turns out that we can have high impact, but only to 1,000 people, great, then that's the size that you get to. And we shouldn't try to push beyond that. We shouldn't try to scale unnaturally past our point of impact. I think what we're doing in many of the products that we work on at All Turtles aren't meant for billions of people. We try to be like more cognizant of what the natural scale is. I think for, you know, we're just trying to make video more fun for everyone. I think that's billions of people. So I think if we can have that impact, if we can demonstrate that we have that market fit, then yeah, then we should get really big. And at some point, once we deserve it, once we've built something with impact, then what you're asking for makes a lot of sense, which is, okay, how do we protect that? How do we make sure that the improvement in people's lives that we're currently delivering is not destroyed because we make mistakes and go out of business? That's a hard question. Let's get to the point where we can definitively say that we're improving people's lives and it's worth saving, and then we'll worry about saving it.
I've so enjoyed this. So I do want to move into my favorite, which is a quick fire round, Phil. So I say a short statement and then you hit me with your immediate thoughts, about 60 seconds per one. Does that sound okay?
Sure.
Okay, so favorite book and why? What must I be reading in quarantine?
Kafka on the Shore, Murakami. I think there's a lot of books that are great because of what's in them. And then I think there's other books that are great because of the effect that they have on you or on me. And so I think this is very much an example of, like, whenever I read this book, I come out of it a different and better person. And so it's not about what the book's about, it's about its effect.
Tell me, what would you most like to change about the Silicon Valley tech scene?
I think the Silicon Valley part of it, which I think is changing. I think that's like the good news behind the recent changes is I think it's fundamentally unfair that exceptional talent, like Mozart level, brilliant, exceptional talent is very, very rare in the world, but it's evenly distributed. But opportunity isn't. And so it is bad for the world that so much of the opportunity for crazy, exceptionally talented, creative, out-of-the-box thinkers is concentrated in the 50 miles around Stanford in San Francisco. I think that it's great for this area, but in terms of the overall talent that is able to be realized in the world and change the world, it's bad. And so I think the thing that I would like to change about the Silicon Valley tech scene is the Silicon Valley part of it. I really want it to be more distributed and more global, and therefore 10,000 times larger.
What's your biggest strength and then your biggest weakness? 30 seconds on each.
The nicest thing that anyone's ever said about me that's kind of resonated is that I try to see inherent conflicts of interest and alignments and just avoid them like way before they happen, which I think that sounds true. At least I'd like to believe that about myself, that I can structure things to avoid persistent long-term conflicts of interest of people and other entities pulling in different directions. And I think you get a lot further if you don't have structural conflict from the beginning. My biggest weakness, I don't know, it's probably the arms. I just have like pretty poor upper body strength. Like if I had to hang from a helicopter in an action movie, I couldn't do it. I don't think I could hang from a helicopter for more than like 2 seconds. So I would not survive the action scenes.
Do you train? Do you do weights?
Do you even lift? I try to, yeah. I mean, it's all gotten harder with quarantine. I took up kickboxing for a while. Now I just bought the Nintendo Switch, the Ring Fit, the little like fitness game, which is kind of fun.
Well, that's not going to work.
I know. I've been on a quest to do pull-ups. So I'm up to, I can do a chin-up. That's like took years, but I can do one pull-up.
That's pretty great. I think I would struggle on a pull-up. Penultimate one. Who's the best board member that you've worked with and why?
Oh, the best board member.
Yeah.
Best board member worked with, definitely Roloff. Roloff's great. Why? I think it's because this almost sounds like maybe, you know, a compliment or damning with faint praise, but I mean it like totally earnestly. Roloff keeps state. Most board conversations are totally stateless, meaning that the board members walk in and they don't remember anything that you talked about before and you start over. And this is the most frustrating thing for entrepreneurs because, of course, like you are living it as an entrepreneur, right? This company is the most important thing. You're spending every waking minute thinking about it. And then you meet with the board once every, you know, 3 months. And of course, they've all got other things. They're not like thinking about your stuff and you start over. So every conversation for the most part is stateless, but not with Roloff. Like Roloff's superpower is he like picks up every conversation exactly where the last one left off. I have no idea how he does it because I don't know how many boards he's on, but I'm sure it's a lot. But he like remembers every conversation. It is very stateful and he like contributes to each one. It's as if he like, you know, thinks about the company as much as you do, which is kind of amazing. So yeah, I don't know. He like probably takes notes or something. I don't know how he does it.
Yeah, no, I have such a man crush on Roloff, which I told him at the end of this episode and he was a little bit surprised. I do want to finish though. Fundamentally, like what does look like in 5 years time when everything goes right?
I think we have re-injected personality and fun into this video-based world and we've made experiences that are much better than they used to be, you know, in the before times. People look at how do they go to the doctor or how they have a team meeting or how they, you know, talk to their parents remotely. And it's just better. It is better than it used to be, you know, back in 2019. We want, you know, 5 years from now to be much better than last year. I think that's it in a nutshell.
Phil, as you can see, I've so enjoyed this episode. It was completely wayward and off schedule. I should totally stop writing these sorting schedules, but thank you so much for this. And I really do so appreciate it.
Thank you, Harry. It's been great to talk to you again.
You are, Harry. Thank you so much for that, Phil.
My word, I always love my chats with Phil, and if you'd like to see more from him, you can find him on Twitter at plibin. Likewise, it'd be great to welcome you behind the scenes here. You can do so on Instagram at hstebbings1996 with two Bs. However, before we leave you today,
I have to say, I just love using AngelList's fund admin platform to manage my investments with 20VC. The team and the platform at AngelList takes care of all my back office needs so that I can focus on working with great founders. Leading fund managers have made over 10,000 investments into 6,000 startups via AngelList, all online and all in one place. And with the recently announced rolling funds, you can easily find and invest in these top fund managers on angellist.com/rolling. And speaking of incredible products that allow you to do things that you simply didn't think were possible before, in 2021, every business is a global business. But how do you pay your global team and comply with international labor laws? Well, Remote handles payroll, benefits, taxes, and compliance to help companies of all sizes to pay and manage full-time and contract workers all over the world, no matter where your team lives and works. Remote's global employment solutions keep your team, your finances, and your IP secure. Remote never charges percentages or fees, just best-in-class global employment solutions for a low flat rate. The world's top companies love Remote. GitLab, the world's largest all-remote organization, trusts Remote to manage their global team, and Remote is funded by Index Ventures, Sequoia, and a host of other top-tier investors. I'm very proud to call myself a Remote investor. And ready to learn more? Well, visit remote.com/20VC today to download Remote's latest research report and start employing in minutes. And as I said, speaking of game-changing products with Remote to use at your company, we've all heard that time is money, and so Ramp says, why don't you save both? Ramp is the only spend management platform and corporate card that can really automate your accounting and lower your bills in under 15 minutes. That's even less than the 20VC podcast, my word. And Ramp allows you to streamline approvals, controlling spend before it happens. Ramp also has this awesome feature where it automatically identifies all active subscriptions and upcoming payments, allowing you to forecast in real time. For these and many more reasons, some of the best used Ramp, including 8 Sleep, Row, Founders Fund, and more. To join the revolution of saving both time and money with Ramp, head over to ramp.com. As always, I so appreciate all your support, and I can't wait to bring an incredible new segment of 20VC called The Memo on Wednesday this week.